And now, ladies and gentlemen, meet the press. Ready for today's unrehearsed, spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. Now meet Mr. Ned Brooks, NBC commentator on national affairs. Mrs. Ruth Montgomery of the New York Daily News. Mr. Frank McNaughton of Time Magazine. Mr. Ernest Lindley of Newsweek Magazine. Finally, Mr. Lawrence Spivak of Mercury Publications, who is our guest moderator today.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and members of the panel. And now, Governor Stassen, if you're ready, who has the first question? Miss Montgomery.
Governor, your letter to Premier Stalin has had the whole world electrified. Why did you think you might be able to solve the Cold War by talking with him when he's broken promise after promise with us for 5 years?
I didn't think I could solve the Cold War, but I thought that it was something that we should always try to work upon. War is so tragic in this modern time that we must explore every possible avenue to move toward peace. And I do believe that it's clear to the Soviet Union from the time of the San Francisco Conference on down that I have only said to them that which could be proven and was clear and correct. And so I think the most important sentence in that letter was the sentence which said that I could not reconcile their conduct in these last years with their expressed desire for peace. Well, and I think that's what led to the Pravda response, and if they do want peace, may lead to the conference.
Oh, Governor, don't you think that you were risking breaking the law, the Logan Act, which forbids an individual American to interfere in foreign policy?
No, that isn't the Logan Act. The Logan Act is that you cannot negotiate for your government its disputes. In essence, that's what it says. Surely it's not against the law to work for world peace. That's what everyone should do, and that's not against the Logan Act.
Well, had
the thing to remember about the Logan Act is that that great Quaker Logan did help establish peace, even though he did cause the law to be enacted.
Well, Governor, had you had any contact, direct or indirect, with any of the Russian delegation at UN before you wrote?
You mean in the period immediately before I wrote and leading to the writing? No, none whatsoever.
Anything that prompted it or anything afterward?
No, the letter was written because of our careful analysis in conference with a group of leading citizens of the country of the whole world situation in these recent months and years. And it seemed clear that the official policy of the United States was one of rather smug aloofness to any discussions or conversations, and the attitude of the Soviet was one of moving on with everybody else toward more armament and also pressing their so-called Stockholm peace offensive, and that it seemed clear that we needed to emphasize to the Soviet Union that if they would move toward aggression, we would intend to defeat them in a Third World War. But if they would change their direction and move toward peace, we'd move with them toward peace. And so that's what led to my August 15th speech and to the letter to Premier Stalin.
Mr. McNaught.
Governor Stassen, did you confer with any officials of this government before you wrote the letter?
No, I did not. Not on the
Why
letter
not?
Itself, no.
Why not?
Because clearly this had to be an action of an individual in the opposition party and not official action of the government.
Well, did it occur to you, Governor, that in doing this that you might jeopardize or defeat some vital plans that this government might have made on the basis of intelligence or diplomatic reports which you didn't know about?
No, it was very clear to us that it would, in fact, move the government in the right direction, and that's what's happened. See, we've kept in close touch to what the government has been doing, and as a matter of fact, I sat in the Asiatic Conference a year ago on policy, and the dangerous moves of our own government were equally clear. So in our rights of leadership and as a private citizen, as a member of the opposing party, we hit very directly at the root of the whole situation in this letter to Premier Stalin. Perhaps I could best describe my position this way. Clearly, we're in a tragic world picture. Here we are with young men going back into uniform throughout the world. We have an armaments race on. We have fighting going on. And we're only 5 years from the end, the victorious end, of a world war. Now, how could this tragic situation arise so soon? I think it has arisen through two things. One, the evil and deceptive policies of Premier Stalin and his government, and two, the weak and confused policies of President Truman and his administration. And so I'm in doing everything I can in the cause of world peace to change the policies of both governments for the sake of mankind.
Well, Governor, don't you think it would have been better if you had coordinated whatever efforts you intended to make with the policy of this government in presenting a united front toward the Russians? Wouldn't it have been better to have conferred with them and see what plans they might have had?
No, because you couldn't make an independent move like this if you conferred with government. It has validity only as the move of citizen leadership presenting it to the opposing government. Furthermore, my experiences arising out of the October 1949 conference in the State Department on Asiatic policy made it clear to me that we must move directly rather than through conferences with the government. In that instance, you recall in Mr. Lattimore's testimony, they tried to use my presence at the conference as an excuse for Mr. Lattimore's line and did not follow the firm recommendations that I made in Asiatic policy a year ago.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. President, and in saying that, I'm not being premature or...
you mean
or
the University of Pennsylvania?
I mean the University
of Pennsylvania. Glad to have your son up there as a student, by the way, Mr.
Thank
Lindley.
You.
It's a great school.
I'm sure it is. You speak of the confused and weak policy of the Truman administration, but
right.
In this case, when you are approaching Stalin as an individual with the idea that you may be able to convince him of something in a personal talk, aren't you pursuing a weaker line than the present administration is in a policy which is based upon building up our strength and not running again to talk things over with Stalin?
No, definitely not. It's never weak to urge upon any other government in the world that freedom of peoples, freedom of speech, freedom of travel, and the right of freedom of worship, and the ending of the persecution of the churches, and those fundamental things, it's never weakness to urge that upon other governments, whether it be Stalin and his government or otherwise. And as you know, I've had experience in direct negotiations with them. I handled very directly at the San Francisco conference, for instance, their attempts to get something to say over the Japanese mandates in the Pacific. I took a very firm and a very clear position, continued to negotiate, and we got their amendments and that out of the charter, and therefore we've had a clear situation in the Japanese mandates in the Pacific. Over a period of years, I've had a considerable number of relationships with them, and it's always been my position that a firm and clear and forthright position, without ever any appeasement, without ever any weakness, is the best chance of moving toward peace with the Soviet Union.
Now, Mr. President, what would if you did talk with Stalin again, what would he have to say or do to convince you that he was ready to adopt a live-and-let-live policy?
Well, Mr. Lindley, I emphasized in the letter, and I've emphasized long ago, that you must judge the Soviet Union's policies by what they do and not by what they say. I think we can demonstrate that dramatically by the fact that the Constitution of the Soviet Union, which I have here...
Which you're not going to read, I trust, Governor.
But I am going to say that it does have an article that the citizens of the USSR are guaranteed by law freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly. So words are not the things that count. The course of action is what counts, and as I indicated in my letter, we would look for a course of action in Eastern Germany, in travel over their borders, in their attitude toward the churches, in the Balkans, that would determine whether they would move toward peace or continue this very tragic drift toward war.
Would you require a complete Soviet withdrawal from Eastern Europe?
I would require in the immediate future the reversal of their trend of arming Eastern Germany. That would be the first immediate step, because if they're going to step up armament of Eastern Germany, we must step up armament of Western Germany and Western Europe, and there goes the armament race with increasing dangers of a world war at each step.
Let me emphasize,
I've urged that we must arm under these circumstances. I've criticized President Truman 3 years and more ago on being too weak and soft toward the communists. Never been my policy to be weak or soft. I sought to stop the shipments to the Soviet Union of things that could be used for atomic development.
Now, Mr. Brooks.
I'd like to ask Mr. Stassen about your recent statement that It's the intention of the administration and the State Department to give aid and support to Communist China immediately after election. I believe you said in your statement that that charge made by you was the result of this Asiatic conference in October of 1949, which you mentioned a moment ago. And I wonder if you could tell us who it was that at that conference who said that we're going to encourage the admission of Red China to the United Nations Security Council.
Well, it was primarily Mr. Lattimore and his associates in the conference. And there were a number of steps that they were recommending. One, that we should recognize Red China. Two, that we should break the blockade of the China coast. Three, that Red China should have the veto seat. Four, that we should go along with the British recognition, which should be the first step should be taken. And a whole series of steps of that kind. Well, I vigorously opposed them in the conference, but yet they went ahead with the British move, and they seem to be moving that way. And then I thought that the Korea decision showed a reverse of that policy. But now, just the other day, in Chairman O'Connor's committee in the Senate, and as you know, he's a Democrat, it's been shown that we, right now, with the Korean War going on, the United States 7th Fleet, under the President's orders, broke the Chinese blockade, and that war materials have been getting through to the Red Chinese. So to me, that's a danger signal that they're going back to the Lattimore policy, and other information I have indicates that they are. And if they do, it'll be a blunder as serious as the Potsdam blunder at the end of the war.
Well, from the contact you've had with foreign policy, do you think that Owen Lattimore really has played an important part in shaping State Department policy?
In Asia, yes, clearly.
Well, do you think he's sympathetic to communism?
I don't know what his sympathies are. I know that the line that the State Department has followed in these 5 years and the line that Mr. Lattimore has urged have helped the communists in Asia. The record shows that, and I think it's been a tragic and terrible situation.
If it's true what you say, that the administration is about to take this important step, and in your judgment it would be more serious, it would offset the victory that we've now won in Korea.
That's right. It would make the bloodshed in Korea in vain.
Well, then, do you believe that in view of this softness that you charge in the administration toward communism, do you think we should have a new Secretary of State? Do you go that far?
Yes, definitely. And I feel, in fact, that we will have a Republican majority in the next United States Senate after these elections, and a Republican majority in the Senate will lead to a new Secretary of State, and one with no record of appeasement of communism in his background.
Governor, do you still expect to hear from Stalin?
Yes, I do.
On what do you base that?
That is, I think their chances are more than even that I will.
Have you had any indication from anybody in the Russian embassy that you will hear from him?
No, I have not.
Well, are you going to Russia whether or not you hear from him?
Oh, no.
You're only going to
I would only go to Russia if there is an indication, definitely, that we would have such a conference, and that the conference could be reported to the whole world, every word that was said by both parties, just as my 1947 conference was reported.
Have you any assurance that you'll get a passport if you do get the invitation?
Yes.
You believe that the State Department will permit you to go and to carry on these discussions?
Yes, I think that's clear. I don't think that they could conceivably stop me from going.
Suppose they did.
Well, I think public opinion would take care of that.
Miss Montgomery.
Governor, last August, during the Korean War, you said that you thought Congress should make a declaration that if the communist Russia tried to invade any other country, or even if its satellites did, that we should then declare war on Russia. Now, if that had been done, wouldn't we now have to be going to war to defend Tibet, perhaps, because of the communist China?
No, you've somewhat overdrawn the speech I made on August 15th. I have it here. I said that we must establish the principle that the actions of the satellites of the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union itself must be held responsible for them. Now, that doesn't mean, and in fact it does mean, that then you bring it up in the United Nations, and you have your hearings, and you take your action through the United Nations. Now, in the case of Tibet, I would think that India is the most primarily concerned, and that if they bring it up in the United Nations, we ought to support their placing it on the agenda and go into it very thoroughly, and then see what is the sound action. But I think it's clear that Mao, the Chinese communist leader, would not be invading Tibet today if the Politburo in the Kremlin in Russia hadn't told him to.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. President, you spoke of the weak policy of Acheson and Truman. You don't regard their meeting the challenge in Korea as a sign of weakness.
No, I said that was an indication to me that they were changing policy.
Well, it isn't.
And now I find that right while the Korean fight was going on, they have opened up the blockade of the Chinese coast and they're permitting materials to go to the Red Chinese forces. And that's revealed by a Democratic Senator O'Connor and his committee. And I find also that they've blocked the flow of supplies to the independent Chinese guerrillas in the south of China. So that, to me, gives grave concern that maybe public opinion just forced the one reversal in Korea, and they're going back to their old softness policy in the rest of
Asia. What evidence of public opinion being brought to bear did you see in the Korean case? After all, the invasion occurred on a late Saturday night here, and on Sunday the administration was already in action.
Right.
President and Secretary Acheson.
Right.
Why do you attribute their action to some great wave of public opinion? Didn't the public opinion rally behind them rather than precede them?
It was both ways. There was a clear opinion long before Korea that there must be a stop to the communist advance, that you could not let them push into every vacuum, and that you must take firm action against it. Matter of fact, I made a speech in St. Louis upon we must go on to the offensive in the Cold War situation. The president then said we were closer to peace than we'd ever been, whereas I had said we were in greater danger of the outbreak of conflict. And the whole indications of the Gallup polls and of all public opinion indications were that the administration was losing in its weak approach to the Cold War. So when the Korea challenge came, I think there was an immediate sense throughout the country that we must meet that challenge.
Governor, we have only 10 short minutes. If you'll shorten your answers, we'll try to shorten our questions.
Well, these big questions, Mr. Spivak, cannot very well be answered by short answers. We're covering the whole world situation in a half hour.
Mr. McNaughton.
Governor, I don't understand what you mean when you say that the 7th Fleet broke the blockade of the Chinese coast. As I read it this morning, they're stopping shipments of oil and all kinds of materials to communist China.
No, those shipments have been getting through since the 7th Fleet broke the nationalist blockade. That's what the O'Connor Committee shows, and
well,
you can read
them.
Your own reports and you'll find that.
They're stopping them in Baltimore and Philadelphia today.
Today, after the O'Connor Committee and public opinion has revealed it, what we need is an administration that evaluates and foresees these things rather than waiting. It's like these atomic shipments to the Soviet Union in 1947. I don't suppose it's generally realized that the atomic energy and the atomic bomb is produced in the Soviet Union with equipment shipped from the United States since the end of the war. Now, that's the amazing situation.
Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Stassen, if we could leave the Far East for a moment and come back over here. A few Sundays ago on this program, Governor Dewey announced his support for General Eisenhower in the presidential election of 1952, and I'm wondering whether you'd like to make it a two-way parlay and give us your endorsement.
Well, I would say, first of all, that I don't think it's any great service to General Eisenhower under the present situation where he's going to be commander of Western Europe to discuss him in political terms.
Well, of course, that has...
I will make my position clear on it, as I think you're entitled to know. I feel this, that if he becomes commander of Western Europe, he is nevertheless available for a draft for the presidency. I think it's always been clear that the only way that he would become president would be under a draft.
Well, you've
I think that it's splendid that he is becoming commander of the Western European forces. I think that was needed. I think that it's too early now to say exactly what anyone will do 2 years hence, whether it be General Eisenhower or myself.
Well, you've been in politics long enough to recognize the symptoms of men who are receptive to presidential nomination. Would you say that General Eisenhower is acting like a candidate?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Well, do you think he's receptive?
He's been acting like a great American, which he is.
Governor, have any of the leading Republicans troubled to find out whether General Eisenhower is a Republican?
Well, I think it's been clear from his public statements that he comes closer to the Republican position in both world and domestic affairs than he does to the Truman administration. That doesn't mean that he isn't a great soldier and that he won't do a top job in command of Western Europe. In fact, I've urged that a year and more ago.
Well, but isn't it true that in 1948 the Democrats thought he was so close to their position that they wanted to nominate him?
I don't think they thought he was so close to their position. I think they were afraid that they were going to lose with President Truman and all get thrown out of office. and they were willing to nominate him to try to save their own political positions.
Well, Governor, does this mean that you're out of the race for 52?
It means that it is more likely that I'll be supporting someone else than it is that I'll be a candidate again myself.
Who's someone else?
Well, I think you have to wait until you approach 52 to see what unfolds between now and then.
Do you think that Eisenhower...
In other words, I think it's too early, and I think that I can understand your constant questions of General Eisenhower and your constant comment about it, but I really don't think that it's helpful to General Eisenhower or the country you to do it.
Because of the fact that it's coming so early, or because of the fact that he's about to take up this job in Europe?
Both. Both.
Mr. McNaughton.
Well, you certainly have some idea of whom you think would be the best candidate, Governor.
Oh, definitely I have some idea, and it's premature to try to give it and to go into it.
Well, Governor, if Governor Dewey is out, and you're out, and Eisenhower is out, is there anybody in the Republican Party who can be elected, in your judgment?
Well, you've got a big if at the beginning on all these people that I will not accept.
You don't think that any of them are really out, then?
No, I think when you come to 52, you have to reevaluate the whole situation and see who is the man who can best lead the American people. I think it's clear that today General Eisenhower is the most popular figure in America, and he's a great leader of the American people.
Mr. Lindley.
You forecast a Republican control of the Senate in the 82nd Congress a moment ago. Are you actively supporting Governor Duff?
Yes, matter of fact, I've been actively supporting the Republican candidates for Senate and the Republican candidates across the country. And you're not quite correct that I opposed Governor Duff in the primary. I opposed his choice for governor. I felt that there was a better man in the field for the nomination for governor, but I was for Governor Duff for the senatorial nomination. I wasn't able to get the other man nominated for the governorship. But I think Governor Duff will win in Pennsylvania and take out the Democratic whip of the Senate. I think Everett Dirksen will win in Illinois and take out the Democratic majority leader. I think in Connecticut, in Idaho, in Utah, and in sufficient states in California, I think Richard Nixon will win that seat. So I think you will see a Republican majority in the next United States Senate.
What about Taft?
Ms. Montgomery.
Yes, I think Senator Taft will win very decisively because of the people's recognition of his very strong character and great ability, and conscientious devotion to what he believes in for the country. So I think he'll win a decisive victory in which Democrats and independents will play a part.
Governor, is your prediction based on the same polls that you used in 1948?
Well, so happened I didn't use the polls in 1948. I wasn't the nominee.
I'm talking about the predictions of victory, though, that were made in 1948 by almost all leading Republicans.
No, this is a matter of judgment on personal observations in these states and from the people in the states.
Mr. McNaughton.
How about Senator Donnell in President Truman's own state of Missouri?
A very close race that I believe Senator Donnell will win in a very close race.
How about the members of the House? Do you expect the Republicans to take control of the House, too?
I think there'll be gains, but not quite enough for a majority. That's what I look for. I think the Republicans will gain 30 to 40 seats. Now, it's possible that in these last weeks, I think, for example, the president's sort of grandstand play in flying out to see General MacArthur and then refusing to talk to General MacArthur about these difficult questions we've been talking about Red China and Indochina, have caused a resentment in the people. And I think that the president now announcing that he's going to make a political speech over all four networks shows that it's an admission that his party is in trouble.
Mr. Lindley.
Governor, do you think the Republicans can or should win the presidency in 1952 with a candidate who has opposed the North Atlantic Pact, who's opposed arming our allies in Europe and elsewhere, and who voted drastically to cut the Marshall Plan at the very outset?
Well, now you're developing a number of hypotheticals for the future. I've already said that you cannot gauge the presidential nominations of 52 this far ahead, and I have indicated very clearly and definitely that I think that Senator Taft will win and should win on the basis of his character and his integrity and his devotion to the whole situation.
Do you think he would be a suitable presidential nominee?
Well, I've already told you that we can evaluate that in 1952, and that's when the people will be evaluating it.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. This concludes our latest edition of Meet the Press.